Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Alex Clark, and Lucy Dallas, the TLS's arts editor, is here with me. Hello, Lucy.
Hello, Alex. How are you doing?
Well, I'm all right. I'm on my travels.
You are? You're on your way to Hay, I believe.
And I'm on my way to Hay, where I will actually see you.
Hooray, because we will do the podcast IRL, as I believe the youth say.
Yeah, we'll be IRL with our colleague Toby Lichtig.
Yeah, which is going to be tremendous.
And I think you've made a kind of super signing.
Well, I can't take any credit for it. But what is brilliant is that we are going to talk to Lise Doucette, the frankly amazing BBC correspondent who, until very recently, she's been right in the thick of it in Ukraine. It turns out she's also incredibly well read and thoughtful about fiction and literature and all sorts of things. So that will be a real treat.
Well, I'm hugely looking forward to it. I will see you. I'm being a little bit of a veteran of Hay, I say pack wellies.
Oh, really?
Yes. The first time I ever went to Hay, I took because I was rather in the sort of mode of what it might be like, I took a sort of white floaty linen dress and I had to buy a pea green fleece. However, it might be lovely. I understand, you know, it's the Jubilee weekend. This is all sort of building up to, isn't it? So probably the sun probably has to shine constitutionally.
I imagine, over the whole realm.
From Hay and our IRL meeting to a lovely letter that I think you've had from our correspondence bag.
It's a wonderful letter. And first of all, saying thank you for giving out the email, because I've been looking for it, but I can't find it. So I just must apologise first that it's taken however long it's taken for us to remember to give you an email address to write to us at. So the letter is from Hebe. I think you say Hebe or Hebe. I'm going to go for Hebe, and I apologise if it's wrong. It's just the most lovely letter, saying that she likes the podcast and been listening for a long time. And actually this, which I would really like to use for our marketing, Hebe, if you don't mind, she says, "You always make me smile and think." I mean, I think that's job done.
Yeah.
Then. Perhaps we should now just retire.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, or we could carry on.
No, I think we should chase more praise. That's what I think. No, I think never rest on our laurels.
Unashamedly.
Let's make more people think and smile.
Well, it's such a lovely thing to say, isn't it?
A lovely thing to say. It's exactly the effect that you know, we'd like the podcast to have completely.
And she won't be able to make it to the live podcast at Hay and Why. Is there any chance of live streaming it? I think it is going to be live streamed, or any further special episodes.
There will be a way that it goes beyond the muddy tent, I promise.
Yes, exactly. And there should be available, and also further special episodes should also be available. She then also says, lots of people are doing videos now. How about doing a bit of video? And when maybe we could see a bit of the fabled TLS offices if you were to do a video podcast. I'm not sure about that one.
Well,
not sure the fabled TLS offices would live up to
No, that. I think that's sort of imagining perhaps a kind of literary Gormenghast.
Yeah, it's the office is in the middle of a volcano, so it's difficult to get a good recording quality. That's the start. And the waterfall is very loud. So we'll take that one on board, but we'll have a think about that one. But the other brilliant suggestion, and this is a really brilliant suggestion, is suggesting that we set up some sort of challenge for our listeners, just a little thing, to suggest buying a secondhand book or reading some poetry.
That's a great idea. And then we might, you know, if people told us about it, then we'd have a sort of, well, we'd have a little gang, and we'd like to have a little gang. We'll start with one of Hebe's challenges. And I suppose because we are, you and I, going to Hay, and Hay is going and is known for, you know, secondhand books. That is its essence. Shall we say that, you know, go and find a secondhand
book. Let's do it.
And tell us about, you know, obviously we love a kind of recherche find. We'd love to hear about those. It's also always, you know, I always think I'm going to find, you know, first edition of Ulysses under a sort of pile of National Geographics. I never do, but you know, if we can do a sort of antiques roadshow, all to the good, don't you think?
Yes, sort of. Also, I have to say we love a bargain, so if you pick up a brilliant book for 10p
send it to us.
Wonderful. And it doesn't have to be, it can be anything. I mean, it could be Topsy and Tim, which again is a great work of literature. I'm not saying it isn't.
I have to say I've immediately sort of swerved this into a kind of mercantilist project, but actually we are saying to find something
you'd like to read. Yeah.
Something that you like to read and tell us about it. Right, I'll move on before I just become ever more vulgar. Coming up on this week's show. We are joined by Lucy Hughes Hallett to talk about the rise, the fall, and the legacy of Italian fascism. And we look back at the tragicomic phase of that great institution, British Rail. But first, what sparked the rise of Mussolini in Italy, and how did it happen so quickly? Why, two decades later, did it collapse just as suddenly? And what has been the impact on successive generations of Italians? Lucy Hughes Hallett, the prize-winning biographer of Gabriele D'Annunzio, has reviewed two books about Mussolini's Italy and joins us now to ponder these and other intractable issues. Lucy, many thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me. It's good to be here.
Let's start with the first book that you look at, John Foote's Blood and Power. And we should mention that John Foote has political pedigree and also personal pedigree when he comes to write this book.
Absolutely, yes. So he's from a great Labour clan. His great uncle was Michael Foote, leader of the Labour Party. His father was Paul Foote, the campaigning journalist, supporter of the Socialist Workers' Party. So John Foote comes from the left, but he opens his book with a reminiscence of a family occasion. Apparently all the Foote family used to collect for big holidays in Cornwall. And his great-grandmother, his Italian great-grandmother, Aurelia, would also be present. And Paul Foote told his son John that it was a kind of refrain of these probably very argumentative, politically engaged dinner party conversation, or rather family dinner conversations, that somebody would say, oh, you know, so-and-so is a fascist. And then great-grandmother Aurelia would speak up and say, oh, fascism, wasn't it wonderful?
That must have caused a bit of a stir, particularly around that family table.
Can you imagine? You just feel that, you know, H.M. Bateman, I mean, it's just a moment when everyone would have been frozen, although I suppose
maybe they were used to it.
Yeah. But of course, then John Foote goes on from there to engage with the fact that, of course, I mean, fascism lasted in Italy for over two decades with the consent of the population. And obviously, there were opponents, and those people who were brave enough to speak up against the fascist regime were very brutally silenced. But the fact is that a large proportion of the Italian nation was complicit or anyway cowed into apparent complicity by the regime. And Foote gives us the kind of historical context for that, the very chaotic and frightening situation in Italy in the years immediately after the end of the First World War. And there were a lot of people from the sort of the liberal establishment who thought that these black-shirted, rather noisy, but apparently so irresponsible people that, you know, there was no reason to suppose that they would ever achieve proper political power. They could be used basically to as kind of vigilantes, as a bit of useful muscle to control the socialists, who seem by far more likely to take over. Everyone, I think, in 1919, 1920, if there was going to be a sudden political change in Italy, they would have expected it to be a socialist communist revolution rather than what eventually happened.
And they feared that, it seems, because they were looking at the example of Russia, and certainly that was what was motivating someone like Paul Foote's great grandmother in her admiration for fascism. It was a sort of bulwark against communism and what had happened elsewhere. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. And it was beginning to happen in Italy. I mean, I think it was 1920 that Trotsky sort of told the assembled Soviets that, you know, we have Italy, you know, our fellow socialists, fellow communists, are on the brink of taking over the Italian state. And there was a brief period when that really did look likely. There were general strikes, there were workers occupying the factories, and those factories became fortresses, very heavily armed. There were sort of arsenals full of weaponry in those occupied factories. The idea that there might be a communist revolution wasn't just a kind of, you know, the kind of paranoid fantasy that one saw in the United States of America a couple of decades later. It really might have happened, but it didn't happen, mainly because there was no proper organization. You know, there was a lot of spontaneous action, but it wasn't centralized. There wasn't an effective leader. And there were some very powerful people who were opposed to it, mainly the people with the money.
And Mussolini kind of comes into this gap.
He suddenly decided that, there is, of course, a longer process behind it, but it seemed sudden to everyone around him that, no, on the other hand, he was pro-war and he was going to celebrate militarism. He was beginning to talk in the kind of way that, with hindsight, we can see was fascist or proto-fascist. And then by the end of the First World War, when Italy was in a pretty desperate state, although it had fought on the winning side with the Allies, it had experienced defeat. In the year before the war ended, there'd been the absolute disaster of Caporetto when the Italians were driven back. You could hear the Austrian guns in Venice. It was pretty desperate. And only in the last few months, really weeks of the war, did the Italians rally. But so a lot of people had deserted. There were a lot of soldiers who were kind of living in hiding, or ex-soldiers, by the end of the war. And apart from those deserters, the soldiers who had fought to the end and who were returning very angry. They felt that they were not being given their share, which was absolutely true. And the other allies, you know, if you read the letters and diaries of the people who were taking part in the talks at Versailles, the French, the Americans, the British, It's disgraceful the way they talk about the Italians. You know, there's a lot of ghastly jokes about ice cream sellers. And the Italians had fought very bravely. They'd suffered terrible losses. I mean, the Italian front was every bit as sort of bloody and deathly as the Western Front, about which we in Britain know so much more, with the only difference being that the Italians were fighting uphill, or rather sort of up mountain, in the mountains on the Austrian border and in deep snow. I mean, it was a terrible, terrible war for them. And having suffered all that, then to find that they just weren't going to be given what they saw as their share of conquered territory or financial support, was very bitter. So that anyone who'd been in the Italian military, whether they'd fought through to the end or deserted after Caporetto, was feeling extremely disgruntled, dispossessed, and outcast.
And also, it seems from the way that you're describing it, also despised, you know, not merely just not getting, you know, a fair share of things, but also treated with contempt. And I wonder if that, you know, also explains some of the emotional appeals of fascism, and of course of Hitler's appeals to his country people too. There is this emotional appeal, isn't there, that you can rise again, at the sort of invocation of the past and the idea that you can be respected and must be respected.
That's a very important point. And Mussolini offered that. You know, he called the returning soldiers the trenchocracy, and these, you know, rather desperate men were given a kind of language, or a sort of a symbolic code within which they could feel that they were heroes, that, you know, they were valued. And that translated into violence. You know, they became the squadristi, the violent gangs, who in the kind of immediate post-war years, under Mussolini's influence eventually, but actually they, you know, they existed really before Mussolini seized control of them. And they felt that as long as they were, you know, wearing their black shirts and roaring around the countryside in their stolen jeeps, terrorizing socialists or people who they considered might be socialist, they felt a kind of self-respect that they had lost.
Mm. It's interesting as well that you say that the kind of, let's say, the centre or even the centre left, the liberal democracy was kind of using them. They were quite useful for them, and they just thought, oh well, we don't need to worry about them. We'll use them to enforce kind of the less palatable things, and then they just assumed that they themselves would continue to rule. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. So it began really with people hiring the squadristi as sort of enforcers. So landowners who were faced with peasant uprisings would, you know, summon in the local black shirts to put down the uprising. And then on a much bigger political stage, the grand old man of Italian politics was Giovanni Giolitti, who'd been prime minister 5 times. And he made the terrible mistake of, he was forming a coalition government, and he asked Mussolini and his followers to join this coalition. And it had never occurred to Giolitti or to any of his sort of patrician colleagues in the Chamber of Deputies that the fascists would really have any kind, could seize any kind of power, because they seemed so rude and crude. But very quickly, of course, they did. And so Giolitti had invited them in, and then once they were in the chamber, it became impossible to control them.
You also make the point that John Foote's book is really powered by the stories of the Italian people. He collects people's stories, doesn't he? I wonder if you could share some of those.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is not a book about, you know, the movers and shakers. Indeed, Mussolini played a comparatively small role in it. It's about what it was like to live under fascism. And so the whole book is a kind of mosaic of small stories which collectively form a bigger picture. And so we have stories about perhaps a local mayor being terrorised first by communists and then by fascists. We have stories about just ordinary people, men, women, people living in small towns and villages, and their experience of this thuggery, which would suddenly overtake these communities. There are stories about Jewish people, including those who were proud to serve the fascist government, who then found that as the sort of anti-Semitism gradually became a part of the fascist program, which only happened slowly, but it's very often thought or said that fascism only really became anti-Semitic after Mussolini and Hitler had formed the Pact of Steel. But Foot shows that actually it was inherent in fascism from quite early on. And then so gradually those Jewish people who had, you know, been officials under the fascist government and were perfectly happy to serve it, suddenly found that they were losing their jobs, their children were no longer allowed to go to their schools, and eventually many of them were deported to the camps. But I'm generalising, but Foote is particular. He focuses always on individual people or individual families, and that gives his book a wonderful vividness and immediacy.
Talked a bit about the rise, the apparently sudden rise and the apparently sudden fall of fascism and of Mussolini that ends, you know, eventually with his vilification and his very sort of, bloodthirsty death. But do you see through these mosaics that it was actually a more gradual process of disenchantment? Did it have to do with the people who had thought that fascism would serve them and then realised it just didn't?
Yes, it's partly that. It's partly how much fascism was initially underestimated, both by those in power and, and by ordinary Italians in the street. But I think that, it is phenomenal how quickly Mussolini went from, I think there are 120 people at the meeting in the Piazza Santapulcro in Milan, which is seen as being kind of, you know, the birthplace of fascism. And in, you know, just over a couple of years, suddenly it was a nationwide movement capable of taking over government. And how that happened is not entirely explicable, I think. And that's true also of a great many revolutions. I mean, you know, a few people in the Winter Palace with one typewriter. Mussolini, he wasn't particularly keen on democracy, but he knew how to work it. And that the old way of doing politics was very powerful people talking to each other behind closed doors, whereas Mussolini knew how to turn out towards the public and to turn politics into theatre. And that, of course, is the way politics is now done. But really, in fascist Italy, it was the first time we saw it being done really effectively. And Mussolini was brilliant at that. You know, the black shirts, the salutes, the songs, all of which, incidentally, originated in Fiume, when Gabriele D'Annunzio took over Fiume just after the war in 1919. And set up a kind of, as it were, a miniature proto-fascist state, which was terrifically theatrical. And Mussolini learnt from that. He visited Fiume under Donatio, and he saw and he took away the importance of engaging with your public, your constituency, as though it was the audience in a theatre. And it worked.
And then it just went. Suddenly the trick stopped working.
Well, of course, the fact that Italy was losing a war had a lot to do with that. I mean, you know, a defeated leader is always going to be a bit of a disadvantage. But yes, it wasn't the anti-fascists who did for Mussolini in the end. It was his own people, his most intimate supporters, including, of course, his son-in-law, Ciano. And at a meeting of the Gran Consiglio, the Grand Council, which he had set up as his own personal instrument of power, he suddenly, and it was sudden to him, I think he really hadn't expected it, found that he had lost his support. They wanted to get rid of him and they voted him out. And he was arrested and then taken off to a place from which he was subsequently released by Germans. And then he had his, you know, his second bite of power during the extraordinary Republic of Salo before the final end, when he was captured by partisans, killed. And as we all know, you know, that terrible image of him being strung up by his feet from the canopy over a petrol station on the outskirts of Milan. But the thing about Foote's book really is that it's not particularly about the rise and fall of Mussolini, although that is such a compelling story. It is much more about the experience of living under that kind of a regime. And a point that he makes very powerfully is the extent to which anyone living in those circumstances somehow becomes complicit. And that's not in any way to blame Italians. I mean, I'm sure I'd have tried to keep my head down and keep out of harm's way, just as most of them did. But he tells chilling stories about moments when, for instance, you know, some fascist thugs were roughing up people on the street, and other people just walked on by. I mean, wouldn't you? You walk on by.
Yes, just out of terror, presumably, just simply thinking, I need to get myself away from this situation or I will become a victim too.
Exactly, exactly.
Yes. I wonder if we could just move on to the other book that you talked about, very provocatively titled book, Mussolini Also Did a Lot of Good, by Francesco Filippi, translated by John Irving. We should probably immediately point out that this is an ironic title.
Yes, yes. Yes, in Italian it's called, but it's a little bit clearer, I think, that Mussolini Also did a Lot of Good. It sure ends up, comma, not.
I suppose it's a book that, you know, its title at face value would be something that great grandmother Aurelia would sort of nod approvingly of, but then what he's really talking about is that subject of sort of historical amnesia and the kind of whataboutism, I suppose, the kind of, you know, well, this happened, but the absolute famous cliche that the trains ran on time. The so-called achievements of Italian fascism, in his view, I think, don't stack up. They don't bear close examination.
That's right. I mean, both Filippi and Foote actually are challenging what they see as a kind of creeping sympathy or acceptance, anyway, of fascism, a sense that you know, as his title says, it wasn't all bad. And Filippi gives us, he basically counters all the arguments, what he calls the idiocies, that are, he says, becoming increasingly current in modern Italy. And so he will say, you know, so people say, oh, yes, fascism was awful, but actually, they introduced old age pensions. They were very good on taking care of, you know, the poor and the weak. And then Filippi comes up with statistics saying, no, you know, actually, old age pensions were introduced in the 1890s under Francesco Crispi. And so he's got an answer to every one of these arguments. It's as though this will be a handbook for you if you were having to talk to John Foote's great-grandmother, Aurelia. And she was saying, oh, but, you know, Mussolini challenged the mafia. And then you could get out Filippi's book and say, well, no, that's not true. You know, the fascists were as disrespectful of the law as the mafia is. And no, they weren't, actually.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
The people who are upholding law and order.
Is it that you could certainly challenge great-grandmother Aurelia, whether she would thank you for it, I don't know. But is there also a sense that it might be needed to challenge people's sort of assumptions today?
That's exactly right. Both these authors are saying that they are alarmed by the sense that the horror and disapproval that surrounded the idea of the fascist regime in the immediate post-fascist years is beginning to wear off, and people are beginning to say, well, it wasn't so bad really, and they need to be reminded that actually, yes, it was.
And I wonder, does he also make a sort of wider point about historical amnesia, you know, and this idea that, you know, we can look and say, well, you know, we haven't had fascism in the UK in the same way it hasn't had ascendancy. But one is still just as much prone, whichever kind of political establishment one has grown up in, with this kind of, you know, these rose-tinted spectacles in a way.
Definitely, yes. Rose-tinted spectacles, and also a difficulty that everyone, I think, in, you know, unwelcome in historical circumstances finds. It's hard to know exactly when you say thus far and no further, this is the moment to say no. And you're absolutely right that both these books describe something that happened in Italy, but they're describing it in order to warn that it could happen elsewhere as well.
Mm. Lucy, thank you so much for talking us through those books. They sound really fascinating and actually very complementary to one another.
That's true. Yes. Well, thank you for letting me talk.
And of course, we will not forget to mention your own book, which, again, would probably make a great trio if somebody wanted to get a proper primer. So if you read these two books in conjunction with The Pike, you'd be doing quite well. Still to come on the show, we ask the important question, were British Rail sandwiches really terrible? And what about the troubled history of BR's nationalisation?
And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode. Thank you. Welcome back to the TLS podcast. I'm Lucy Dallas. What do you think might link, however tenuously, sandwiches, buses, the common carrier, chamber pots, and the Johns Lennon and Major? It's an impossible question, really. You'd have had to read the book we're talking about to answer. And the answer is, surprisingly, British Rail. Andrew Martin is reviewing a book about what he calls the tragicomic phase of its nationalisation, and he joins us now to talk it through. Andrew, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So the book you're reviewing is called British Rail, A New History by Christian Wolmar. And it is about the railway, but it's also, it seems to be also about British history and politics and geography and business and all sorts of things, isn't it, really?
Well, in a way, it's about the most interesting period of Britain's railways, namely British Rail, or British Railways, as it started out being called, and the nationalised incarnation of our railways. And the basic story is of how, having nationalised the railway, we didn't know what to do with it. The difficulty with the railway is that it provides a very elemental thing. It provides movement, and movement is necessary for almost every other activity in our society. Mm. So surely you should give it the support, this enterprise, the support it needs. It's like it provides air.
Yeah.
But it never got that support. And constantly undermined by the Treasury wanting to cut back the funding. And according to Christian Wolmar, it was persistently subsidised at a much lower level than the nationalised railways of our European competitors. So that's why I call it tragicomic. There would be bursts of enthusiasm. Suddenly there'd be a kind of investment plan. In particular, there was the very ambitious modernisation plan of 1955. Which Wolmar calls back of the envelope stuff. It was developed very quickly, and there were strange proposals for things like helicopter landing pads to be incorporated in railway stations.
That would be exciting, wouldn't it?
Well, it has lots of exciting ideas. Marshalling yards, great big distribution points where freight would be, trains would be shuffled about so that wagons would be distributed into different trains and set off different corners of the country. There was one near me in York where I grew up, and you could hear it rattling away all night. They fizzled out pretty quickly as well. There were some good things that emerged out of the modernisation plan, like the electrification of the West Coast Main Line. I think that's where that originated. But lots of eccentric things that that didn't persist. And this was the story over and over again. Stop, go. Enthusiasm, then cutbacks. Enthusiasm, then cutbacks. And persistently low subsidy, because we as a nation just seemed to be prejudiced against our railway. Didn't believe in it. Thought it was old-fashioned.
Hence, when we do go abroad and use another train, we're still just surprised and amazed at how great everybody else's trains are.
Yeah, you're generally awestruck. Yeah. I mean, even in France. And the SNCF in France, its reputation has taken a bit of a knock recently. In fact, I'm part of an organisation, I sometimes go along to their meetings, they were called the SNCF Society, but then now they've just called themselves the French Railway Society, because, as I say, SNCF hasn't been doing so well recently, and it's been cutting back itself. But generally speaking, if you go on a high-speed train in France, it's just sheer luxury, sheer bliss. I managed to do that during a gap in lockdown, went to Nice from Paris. It was the highlight of my holiday, even when I had a nice evening.
You are fond of trains, mind you.
But everyone's fond of those trains.
Yes.
You're sitting in what is essentially an armchair, often, if you like, on the second
floor.
Yes,
that's the thing I love. They're like double deckers. It's so exciting.
It's just like a rocket, and so smooth, and a nice buffet car. So we invented trains, but somehow we'd never really believed in them. And what we did believe in very strongly was the motor car, and because that seemed to symbolise freedom to us. You know, we're a sort of anti-state society. I can't remember what the right word is, but we're a laissez. We built our railways by laissez-faire, by which I mean chaotically, with lots of duplication. And we don't believe in state enterprises, and that was the basic problem for BR, all the time, car use increasing very rapidly.
Yeah.
And people had a real liking for cars and didn't like the trains. Trains were the past.
Can you tell us along those lines? I wanted to ask you about, as you say, it did face lots of stiff opposition from some unlikely areas. Tell us about the Railway Conversion League.
This was a group of nutty ex-army men, I think. That's how Waldemar characterises them. A couple of army officers sort of founded this organisation, and it believed that all the railways should be torn up and replaced with roads. And you would have a succession of high-speed coaches, buses, instead of trains. And my dad, who worked for BR in sort of the finance side of it, was at the mercy of a rail replacement eccentric in the shape of my Uncle Peter, who was his brother-in-law. Uncle Peter did not like my dad, and he would come to the house, and he was a big car man himself, and he drove a nice car, and he would come into the house wearing his car coat, and he would take his driving gloves off. But that's about as far as it went. His catchphrase was, "Not stopping, Bill."
Well, unlike your so-called railways, that sort of thing.
My Uncle Peter promoted this rail replacement scheme. And my dad rebutted it one day. He said, "Well, OK, Peter, so you have all these fast coaches. Presumably you'll sort of straighten all the roads out and have very efficient road network." He said, "Yes, that would be part of the plan as well. We'd use the main motorways and build more motorways." And my dad said, "And the buses would run in quick succession, right?" And Uncle Peter said, "Yes, that's right. They'd be almost sequential, one after another, very quickly. So you'd hardly have to wait for a bus." And my dad said, "OK, so you've got a series of buses running in a straight line, very close together. Peter, that's called a train." And I thought that was my dad being genius. But in fact, it's revealed in Waldemar's book that this rebuttal was, in fact, the work of Richard Marsh, one of the BR chairmen. That's how he argued against. So it was his neat conceit.
Well, it is a very good rebuttal, whoever it comes from. And the thing is that they wanted a rail replacement bus, but forever. Imagine that. Imagine the horror of the whole transport system being the rail replacement bus.
The low point for BR was Dr. Beeching, who I often mention in print, and then quite often sub-editors and people like that come back to me and say, "Our younger readers are not going to know who this is." But so just to explain, you know, he was the chairman of BR in the early 60s, and he implemented a cutback plan whereby he cut the network by a third. And at the behest of Ernie Marples, who was the transport minister at the time, very much a car man and a real sort of caddish figure, known for wearing brown suits, blue suits and brown shoes. He found trains boring.
This is the transport minister.
This was the transport secretary. Yeah. And he appointed Dr. Beeching, who had been the head of ICI, a scientist, and quite deliberately a scientist, not a railway man. So a calculated insult to the injury, to the industry. And Beeching came along and cut it by a third. And what strikes me about Beeching is the sheer wrongness of it, of what he did. As Waldemar says, the pursuit of the subsidy. He did it purely to cut financed to save money. And as Waldemar says, the pursuit of the subsidy-free railway was a holy grail that could never be found, and it never was found. And Beeching's cuts made very little difference, apparently, to the BR need for subsidy, but they cut whole towns out of the life of Britain. I mean, Waldemar mentions Louth, I think that's how you pronounce it, in Lincolnshire, a town that he'd been to as a boy and very much liked. And then he revisited it later on after it had lost its railway, which he'd lost because of Beeching. And he thought, what a nice place this is, with a lovely old cathedral and charming Georgian streets. And he reflects in the book on how it could have been a major tourist destination if only people could get there on public transport. Mm. And my equivalent of Louth was Whitby, growing up in York. There was still a railway line to Whitby from York, but you had to, thanks to Dr. Beeching, you had to go via Middlesbrough, and it took about 4 hours. It
takes a long time to get there, yeah. Almost wherever you're from, it takes a long time.
Hardly ever went to Whitby from York, and that's because of Dr. Beach. And every time we did go to Whitby, we loved it. And it missed out on my pocket money for year after year, not very much, admittedly, but multiply that by a million times. And Whitby was out big time because of Beeching, and many, many towns did. And then by any modern criterion, what he did was a disaster from the health and safety point of view. All the people who died because he turfed them onto the roads.
They didn't wear seatbelts. Well, seatbelts weren't compulsory, were they? No
seatbelts, and you could drive drunk and everything. So how many people died because of Dr. Beeching? I mean, that's not, well, I doesn't try to quantify that, but I mean, I'd be interested to know that. And then health and safety, and then the environmental perspective. It was a disaster from that point of view.
I mean, we would be a totally different nation, wouldn't we? It would be an entirely different nation had Beeching not come along. whole towns would have different identities, population. You know, it may be that we wouldn't have so much antipathy towards major population centres from people who don't live in them and find themselves frustrated because they simply can't get anywhere.
Yes, I think Britain would have been very different. I think it would have been a more civilised place. And now it's impossible to close a railway line. And quite a few, I don't know the exact mileage, but quite a few of the railways close by Beeching have been reopened. So this is, again, proof that he was wrong. But what he did seems just inconceivable from the environmentalist point of view. And people often sort of exonerate Beeching. Well, they're on two counts. One, only obeying orders. But he was very enthusiastic about cutting the railways. He wasn't just obeying orders. And then the other one, well, he didn't have a crystal ball. So couldn't see that towns would be overwhelmed with car congestion, pollution and noise blight. Again, I don't think this is in Walmart's book, but other people did have a crystal ball. One of them was John Betjeman, and he persistently opposed everything that Beeching did. He said Beeching is making this country much more unpleasant because of car congestion, because of noise, psychological effects of all that.
It's also, as you say, because it was about numbers. There does seem to have been no thought about the geography or the local history or the fact that, as you say, you were cutting off whole sections of people from essentially the kind of life of the nation almost.
There was no thought for the social benefits of railways. That was not taken into account at all. And then slowly that idea was introduced, and it was legislated into being by Barbara Castle, who was a Labour transport minister in, I think, the late 60s. And she recognised the social value of railways. And that's about when the Beeching closures came to an end. Although his closure programme was implemented in full. So the idea of a social railway came along a bit too late. Mm. And even after it was, the notion was created, it remained a rather vague notion. And people continued to want to, people involved in BR still wanted to cut lines after Beeching. The idea never quite went away of the virtue of simply cutting lines. But there was the slow development of the idea of a social railway. And now that idea is pretty strong. And that's why you can't close a railway line today. Mm-hmm. There are all sorts of ideas that Beeching had about how people would use transport, their railway having been cut, and these were just wrong. One was bustitution, you know, that there would be a bus.
What a horrible word.
It's a horrible word. That gives you an idea of the sort of merit of it, doesn't it? But the buses tended to disappear. Somebody, I think possibly Marina Hyde in The Guardian, it's attributed to different people, but said the most depressing words in the English language are rail replacement bus service. But that one, his other idea was that people would drive. Yes, they would take their car to the nearest railhead, and then they would do, i.e. to the big line, and then they would travel on the train once they'd driven to the main line.
Where would they park?
They just drove all the way in practice, you know. So that was another notion of his that was wrong. But Beeching is given some credit by Walmart, and I think it's very interesting. Apparently Beeching, who was not an aesthetic man to look at, but he was very important in the sort of design revolution that was involved in BR. And I don't think I'd given that proper credit. I'm never much like the trains of the 70s, that kind of mid-blue called rail blue. But Walmart talks that up and says that was a very clever idea, that colour. And he convinced me that it was all quite beautiful, really. And he puts BR's design on a par with the design of London Transport in the 1930s. You know, Harry Beck's map and all the beautiful tiling in the stations and signage and all the posters and how elegant that all was. And he makes a strong case that BR was just as good. And he says the design manual for BR was regarded as a classic. And at the end papers of his book, which is very handsomely produced, there's examples of BR typefaces. And it all looks great, actually. And so that's something that Beeching did that was commendable, I suppose.
Right. Well, that's very even-handed to...
he was still a rotter.
To give him kudos for that. I mean, it did work, as you say. It was all very stop-start, wasn't it? But there was about a decade in which it prospered and worked, and then suddenly John Major came along. Is that right?
Yeah, John Major needed his own privatisation scheme, and I said in my review, kind of summarising what I think Waldemar says, which is that for Thatcher, the BR brought out the pragmatist, even in Margaret Thatcher. She knew that it would be a difficult privatisation because the railway would continue to need subsidy. But John Major just ploughed on with it and won an election he wasn't expected to win. So in a way, the privatisation happened sort of by accident. But the last decade of BR, according to Waldemar, was its golden period. And there were two chairmen called Bob Reid.
One after another,
I think.
That's very confusing.
Well, doubly confusing because their initials were BR.
Maybe that's why they got the job. No, because they were good.
They're both good, apparently. But the first Bob Reid brought out a change in the management structure, which is very dry stuff, but it's briskly explained by Waldemar. And he makes it pretty interesting. A thing called sectorisation, where the railway was reorganised into the different jobs that it had to do rather than on a regional basis, which had been the principle of its organisation before that. And when it had been organised on more of a regional basis, there had been rivalries between the different regions because they had previously been different railways. And the Western region inherited all the arrogance of the Great Western Railway,
okay,
which was a maverick outfit, did everything differently to everybody else, signaled the wrong way and everything. So that's all quite technical stuff, but so it's quite brave of Waldemar to take it on, and he devotes quite a lot of space to it, but it's all done very readably.
Mm-hmm.
And he convinces you that BR was doing well at the very moment.
And he's a well-known writer on railways, isn't he? So is it a tale well told? Because you say he's having to go through some fairly dry and counterintuitive stuff.
Yes, he's written, I don't know how many, but more than a dozen books about trains, I should think. And he is our leading writer on railways. And the interesting thing about this book is it's not like reading the railway magazine, which I sometimes do, because the railway magazine takes for granted that you will know what a diesel multiple unit is. But Waldemar tells you. So he writes for the layman, and it's like his mission is to explain railways to people who are not train spotters. And he likes to decry any romantic attachment to it. He does that at the beginning of all his books, you know. But he obviously was a train spotter as a boy. And there's a little rather charming anecdote about how an early enterprise of BR was motor rail, whereby you would put your train... put your car onto a train.
That sounds practical.
Well,
I suppose it's like the Channel Tunnel, isn't it?
But it's like what people used to do at the very beginning of railways, because rich people would put their carriages onto a flatbed truck and go on trains like that. But Waldemar talks about how he went to the motor rail terminal at Kensington Olympia. I suppose it would have been in the early 60s or late 50s. Mid 60s it would have been, with his dad, to watch the cars being loaded onto the trains.
Ooh.
So he, and at that point, he does admit that he had been a train spotter.
He was sort of hooked at that. And now, I know that a lot of this, you know, diesel multiple units wouldn't mean a lot to me, I can't lie. But it's not all like that in this book, is it? I mean, there are stories about, for example, chamber pots.
There's lots of colour in it. By the way, a diesel multiple unit, he explains it very nicely, essentially coaches with engines underneath. I once had to explain
what a
multiple unit was, and I found it very difficult to explain, so he's explained it very neatly there. Now, there's lots of colour in it, and he talks about an early design of sleeper carriage done by BR, whereby there was mod cons like electric shaver points, but then to get rid of the night soil, or whatever you call it, there was a device where you put the chamber pot into some sort of little cupboard. Then you slammed the cupboard door and the chamber pot was automatically emptied onto the tracks.
That sounds fairly neat.
I think it worked. But so it's full of nice little details like that. Also, one thing that I found very compelling was that he identified the kind of acrid smell that was on the HST. These fast streamlined diesels, which I used to spend half my life on going between York and London, and it was an acrid smell, and it was to do with the brakes in some way, and some people quite like the smell.
Mm.
It certainly had a
very evocative.
I can imagine that smell right now. And it has it's a sort of Proustian transportation. As soon as I think of it,
there's an awful lot of it goes on in my family too, because my late father-in-law was a porter, who was a night porter, who worked away a lot of the time and did the Penzance run from Paddington. And had an extraordinary fund of stories, not least about two very wealthy women who had him up all night, one night, asking for cups of tea and hot water bottles. And then as the train got back to London, he found they had left their bloomers and they hadn't given him a tip at all. They'd left their bloomers in the carriage, and he went up the a platform.
Did he wave them? Was he waving them?
Deliberately to embarrass.
In revenge.
So,
madam, you've left your bloomers.
He was waving. And you won't ask me for a hot water bottle at 3 o'clock in the morning again.
I think trains are very strongly connected to memory, because it's inherently a sort of adventure to get on a train. You're a bit discombobulated in various ways. You're a bit anxious. Will you get there on time? Will you miss the train? And then you go from one place to another. I think Proust said something to the effect that there's something heartbreaking about any leave taking on a train. You do have that kind of you do have that sort of stomach churning sensation slightly. I think I once did a book about moquettes, which is the material seats, train seats and bus seats are made of. And this huge range of these have existed in Britain. And we're particularly good at moquette. We make beautiful moquettes, and you can see them on the London Underground. It's wool. It's a French word for carpet. And that got a strong response, that book, because people would be instantly taken back to the time of their life when they saw that moquette.
That particular one.
That's what remember about a train carriage, it turns out, is the colour of the seats.
And the smell. Yeah.
And the smell.
Yeah.
The London Transport Museum does an absolutely roaring trade in that. I mean, I have one myself in those very things.
Yeah, it goes on. It goes according to the demographic. And the popular one has been in recent years. I can't remember the name of it, but it was on the District Line in the sort of late 70s. And it's a kind of mustardy colour. And that worked because the people who remembered that are now they're Londoners in their middle age with money to spend. So that explains why that maquette was very popular.
Maybe if you live on the District Line.
They lived on the District Line, which is pretty well
known. So it goes through some nice areas, doesn't it, the District Line? I'm going to end by asking an unrelated, though still train-related question. It's not related to the book, I'm afraid. But I just wanted to ask, what is your favourite train journey?
I think that journey that I mentioned from Paris to Nice, that's very nice. And I like the train journey from London to York, since that's my sort of standard journey. Although really the East Coast Main Line, which is the line you take ship to, only gets interesting after York. It becomes very beautiful, but there's certain little signifiers on that line. There's a ruined windmill that you see as you approach York. And that's, to me, very moving and galvanising. And there's certain moments on that line when London sort of recedes behind you. And there's a certain junction, it's near Newark, I think. The train gives a kind of throb. And I always think, right, London's gone now.
That's a lovely reminder. Thank you so much, Andrew, for joining us and talking to us today.
Thanks.
We have time for this week. Our thanks go to Lucy Hughes-Hallett and Andrew Martin.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast. And even huger thanks go to Sophia Franklin, because this is her last episode, I'm very sorry to say. So we salute Sophia and we say thank you and all the best for the future.
We really do. And I have to also say, Sophia, thank you for your patience.
Shall we not say why? We'll just say thank you.
Podcasting's most patient producer. So we wish you all the best in future endeavours, and gosh, hope that you may one day return to us. We'll be back next week, sort of. We'll be joined by Toby Lichtig and we'll be in Hay. But for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.